I didn't announce it, but I decided to change the subject of our discussions for several reasons. One of the reasons is that I'm teaching it now in Vrindavan, and I find it very, very enlivening. I'd like to start now Panchalila of Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's very philosophical. It also has a lot of culture and stories. I think it'll be satisfying to everyone. So let's begin. Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda Jai Advaita Chanda Jai Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Pangum Langayate Shailam Mukham Avartaye Shrutim Yakripa Tamaham Bande Krishna Chaitanya Ishwaram. I offer my respectful obeisances to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, by whose mercy even a layman can cross over a mountain and a dumb man can recite Vedic literature. Om Vijnana Timanandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Taksulimulatam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Namo Mahabhadanyaya Krishna Prema Pradayate Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya Namne Gola Shishe Namaha. So we're going to begin Antalila, and as with any spiritual text, it begins with prayers. Antalila begins Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's life, his 48 years, the first is Adilila. Till 24, he takes sannyas. And then for 6 years, he's based in Puri, but he's traveling. And the last place that he travels in the sixth year of his sannyas is Vrindavan. And then after that travel, he returns to Puri and stays there for the last 18 years of his life. Of course, I was just in Puri also, and it's I have a vivid memory of the place, and it's Vipralamba Kshetra. It's the place of the mood of separation, which is apropos for Chaitanya to settle there, because the Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the full manifestation of Krishna coming to get, experience, nourish, and achieve to the highest degree the sentiments of his topmost devotee, which is Srimati Radharani, at the height of her mood. And the height of her mood was separation. And therefore, it's very apropos that when Chaitanya or Krishna in manifest as Chaitanya wants to achieve this mood, he goes to the place where it is exemplified to the highest degree. Even the deity of Lord Jagannath, which is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Ishtadev, which he even worshipped when he was traveling in South India and stayed in Trivandrum at the home of Venkata Bhatta. He fashioned a deity out of wood as Jagannath, which in Gaudiya Vaishnav law, Gaudiya Vaishnav theology, is a deity of Krishna in relationship to Radharani in the mood of separation. So it's a very, very apropos place to worship the deity Jagannath, who in the Krishna law, the hands withdrawn and the bulging eyes a symptom of ecstatic love to the highest degree. And in relationship to Krishna, the story is, it's the mood of love to the highest degree. In relationship to Srimati Radharani, so it's the perfect deity for Krishna to worship, to experience the mood of Radharani, because it's a deity of Krishna specifically in an ecstatic mood in relationship to feelings of separation from Radharani. So now he goes to Puri, and this is the internal reason for his descent. Chaitanya has an external reason for his descent and an internal reason for his descent. External reason for his descent is the reason that he appears for others, and the internal reason for his descent is the reason he appears for himself. He appears for others to spread Krishna consciousness, prema bhakti, braja bhakti, and he comes for himself to really taste that deeply and taste that mood of Srimati Radharani deeply. So, Anchalila, in one sense, although it's really not till the end of Anchalila that the more esoteric sentiments are expressed, is the, you know, the culmination of Krishna consciousness. Sri Krishna Bhakti Rasa Bhavato Mati, that mood of your relationship with Krishna, exhibited to the highest degree. So, it's apropos that it begins with prayers, because prayer is the consciousness of humility that allows one to experience mercy. And the experience of mercy is the greatest impetus for love, which must be realized to explain love or explain devotion. This is not an easy task for Krishnadas Kaviraj. The subject matter is very, very exalted, and he has to express it in the medium of poetry. It takes great inspiration, it takes great mental concentration, and he's an extremely old man. I think he's in his 90s now, late 80s, 90s. So he's going to offer prayer. And what prayer does, it acknowledges the glory of God in relationship to the glory of God's quality of mercy, and puts one in a position to feel it. So, to actually enter into these pastimes and enter into these understanding, one needs mercy, and therefore one must pray for mercy. Because that is the practice that qualifies one or attracts mercy. It is mercy. There's nothing one can do to earn something as exalted as the glory of God and the glory of God's love. And if you do feel that you can do something to achieve it, you have limited your conception of how valuable it is. our conception that it's so valuable, there's no price that can be paid for it. So to have any conception of God's mercy first requires a deep sense of humility, whereby one feels he's not qualified for it. Even if one feels he's qualified, he's not qualified enough for this. And the process of attracting mercy is to show one's need and desire for it, which has to culminate in dropping to the floor on one's knees and begging for it. And this is one's hope. One's hope is not in one's qualification, but one's hope is in God's mercy, which can bridge the distance between the price one is able or capable of paying for God's mercy and the value of God's mercy, which is so far beyond anything you can do to achieve it. So he's offering respectful obeisances to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, by whose mercy even a lame man can cross over a mountain and a dumb man can recite Vedic literature. This is the mood. It's bhakti. Bhakti is a certain consciousness, a certain glory of the soul, of realizing the dependence of the soul. It's a joy, but not for one in egotistical consciousness who has the objective of being great. Today is the appearance day of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta, and I read one article about Srila Bhakti Siddhanta. And it was about Ekalavya, who was born in a low caste family, but had this desire to be a great archer. She approached Dronacharya, and Dronacharya rejected him because he wasn't from the proper birth or whatever reason, he rejected him. And Ekalavya fashioned a deity of Dronacharya, and then he became even more expert than Arjuna. And Arjuna had a benediction from Dronacharya that anyone, that he would be the top archer in the world. So when Arjuna saw the prowess of Ekalavya and how it superseded him, he went to Dronacharya, and then Dronacharya was anxious to find Ekalavya and then said to him, "You consider yourself my disciple?" "Yes." He said, "Then I want to ask Guru Dakshin." "What is that, Guru Dakshin?" "You give me your thumb." He cut off his thumb, and the archer needs his thumb. The Bhakti Siddhanta was saying, no, Dronacharya is not cruel. There is a defect in Ekalavya. And what is the defect? The defect in Ekalavya is that he worshipped Guru, not for the service of Guru, but because he wanted to become bigger and better and even surpass the Vaishnava, Arjuna. So this is the material disease. But a Vaishnava, near Matsaranam Sitam, he is free from envy, that desire to be greater, that disturbance that someone may be better than one. Vaishnava is free from that competitive nature because he's basking in the glory of the soul, which is humility, which is devotion. We have to become convinced of this. The only way we can become convinced of this is to serve in the humble mood and experience the glory of that position. And to develop our attraction to Krishna and develop love in our hearts to such a degree that our sole objective in life is his pleasure, not our prestige or position. So the first prayer, he's offering a prayer to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who has mercy. And the mercy can make one or allow one to achieve way above one's qualification, which is required for Krishna to write this. Okay, my battery is going to go off. I'm going to have to plug it in. 1 second. Hare Krishna. Can you hear me?
Yes, Maharaj, we can hear you.
Okay. Which is to bridge the gap. And what is the gap here? A lame man needs to cross a mountain. A dumb man has to recite Vedic literature. And Krishna Das Kaviraj is thinking, and I have to write at this old age, this deep subject of Rasa Tattva. And the reader approaching it is thinking, and I am trying to understand this, because it's not just an intellectual endeavor. Dugame pati mendasya skave paragatir muhu svakripayasti danena santa santavalambanam. My path is very difficult. I am blind and my feet are slipping again and again. Therefore, may the saints help me by granting me the stick of their mercy as their support. I'm slipping. The path is difficult. I'm blind. So get this, the path is difficult, I'm blind, and I'm slipping. So what is the chance of crossing that path? He feels this. He feels this. Because to write transcendental literature, it's not just an intellectual endeavor. Something must have to be given to you beyond your intellectual capacity. Some type of inspiration must be there. So he's feeling completely in a mood of dependence, but there's also a faith in the power of the orders of his guardians who have asked him to write this. And that's Krishna consciousness. With the order comes the power to achieve it. And therefore, in a devotee's calculation, he sees what is the wishes of his teachers. That's his primary calculation in moving forward with anything. And if the blessings are there, then one has confidence in executing that order, but not confidence in one's own power, confidence in the mercy of and empowerment of his superiors. So he's slipping, blind, he needs a stick. And what kind of stick does he want? The Swakripa Yashti. He wants the stick of their mercy. So this is his bhav. Completely essential. Not artificial. Not an intellectual conception. It's something that one feels and realizes. Sri Rupa Sanatan Bhatta Raghunath Sri Jiva Gopal Bhatta Das Raghunath H.I. Gururo Koron Charanabhadan Yahahoite Bignanash Abhishtapa. So evidently Narottam Das Thakur may have gotten his line from here. I pray to the lotus feet of the six Goswamis, Sri Rupa, Sanatan, Bhatta Raghunath, Sri Jiva, Gopal Bhatta, Das Raghunath. So all impediments to this literature will be annihilated, and my real desire will be fulfilled. Purport, if one wants to benefit the entire world, he will certainly find persons like hogs and pigs, who put forward many impediments. That is natural. Because what is benefiting the entire world? Benefiting the entire world is awakening within people's hearts an understanding of the self. Which is threatening to people who are in the false conception of the self. Because the false conception of the self is I am the enjoyer and the controller. So, when spirituality becomes prominent, those type of people resist it. That is natural. But if a devotee seeks shelter at the lotus feet of the six Goswamis, the merciful Goswamis will certainly give the Lord's servitor all perfection. It is not astonishing that impediments are placed before those who are spreading the Krishna consciousness movement all over the world. Nevertheless, if we adhere to the lotus feet of the six Goswamis and pray for their mercy, all impediments will be annihilated, and the transcendental devotional desire to serve the Supreme Lord will be fulfilled. So this is entering a life of prayer. Prayer can only be done from a position of humility. So the act of prayer itself moves one in harmony with who one is. Prayer is the voice of the soul. So one who wants to move towards the soul, he has to enter the life of prayer. Our actions and our words influence our consciousness and our feelings. When I was young, I used to, with my brother was a fight fan. So there's my older brother, so I became a fight fan. And we even got to see, we went to the Felt Forum, where Muhammad Ali was, having a public training session. And as some of you remember, he would say, "I am the greatest. I am the greatest. I am the greatest." That's not prayer. But if he said, "You are the greatest," referring to God, "You are the greatest. You are the greatest," that's prayer. Prayer is done from a subordinate position. So this is manifesting naturally from Srila Krishna Das Kaviraj's heart. Jayatam Sirito Pangor Mama Manda Matirgati Matsadasva Padambo Jo Radha Madana Mohano. Glory to the All Merciful Radha and Madana Mohan. I am lame and ill-advised, yet they are my directors, and their lotus feet are everything to me. So this is the prayer to enter into devotional service. There are seven major temples in Vrindavan. The first one that one approaches is Madan Mohan. The deities which exemplify Sambandhagyan, and basically Sambandhagyan means metaphysical knowledge. It's knowledge of reality. And in Gaudiya Vaishnav conception, reality is Krishna and Krishna's energies, and the energies are meant to serve its source. We are also part of Krishna's energies, and we're meant to serve the source. And that brings one to the platform of universal love. Of course, to serve God in full cognizance of God's position as the consciousness which is inclusive of everything brings one to a platform of universal love, because you're actually loving everything. By loving God, and you love everything individually because they're part of God. That's our position. We have this consciousness, and rather than being the object for the universal desire, we want to be the center, and we want to see other things in relationship to us. When Brahma became purified by Krishna because he became proud of his position and bewildered, when Krishna wanted to give him a vision to enlighten him, he showed him a vision of how everything is around Krishna. And it's inclusive in Krishna. Everything's around Krishna. That's what Krishna means. That's what God means. We're also around Krishna. And we're in the position of his servants. So right now, when one has profound lust, it moves one into the position of the center, and one sees other objects in relationship to the fulfillment of one's lust. So entering spiritual life means to loosen our relationships artificially with the world, and develop our natural attachment to Krishna. But the glue that makes the pure soul identify with the material body is lust. So then, without Mohan, in the form of Krishna, is a form of Krishna who conquers lust. So therefore, to establish your relationship with Krishna, you have to conquer your lust. You have to conquer your infatuation with other relationships. Again, as everything is part of God, we can serve others and develop loving relationship with others, which is most satisfying to our own psychological needs. But we can see others as part of Krishna. Divya Vidaram Yakopa Dumada Srimad Bhatma Gara Singhasanisto Srimad Radha Srila Govinda Devo Prashtali Vishayamana Ushmanami. In the temple of jewels in Vrindavan, underneath the desire tree, Sri Sri Radha Govinda served by their most confidential associates, sit upon an effulgent throne. I offer my humble obeisances unto them. So, where the Radha Govinda Mandir is one of the yoga pits. There's also one by Vrindakund. There's a few. Yoga pit means the place of union. There are certain places in Braj, in the Krishna law, the Krishna Leela, where all the associates surround Radha and Krishna in their proper positions of service. So first surrounding Radha and Krishna are the Astika Sakis. And each of the Sakis or close girlfriends has Manjari. So then there's the Astika Manjaris. Hey. It's a meditation that deep sadhakas perform. They meditate on the yoga pit. And one of them is by Radha Govinda. In the morning or the afternoon or the evening, Radha and Krishna sitting on a throne surrounded by the various devotees in their proper places. This is a meditation. Understand what that yoga pit is and to have the aspiration and the qualification to enter it for that type of formal service. So it's a Ratnaghara Shinghasana. So in a temple of jewels, they're sitting on a throne. Underneath a Kalpa Vriksha tree, and they're served by their most confidential associates. So this is Abhideya Gyan. This is the means of realizing that absolute truth. The means is to serve in a sincere way. Shriman Rasa Saram Bivam Si Bhata Tata Stita Karshan Venu Sanai Gopir Gopinath is the, and then there's Gopinath. Shri Gopinath originated the transcendental mellow Virasa dance on the shore of Vamsivat and attracts the attention of the coward damsels with the sound of his flute. May they all confer benediction upon them. So there's three aspects of knowledge, a metaphysical aspect, and there's an ethic or a means of realizing the absolute truth. This is the absolute truth. Now, how do I act in relationship to the absolute truth so that I can realize the absolute truth? And then there's one branch of philosophy called Priyojana. Priyojana means the result or the goal. So in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, this is the goal. The goal is to realize Krishna and to love Krishna and to serve Krishna according to our full capacity to please him. So Gopinath is Priyojana Tattva. Are there any questions?
Maharaj?
Yeah, Moody.
First of all, Dhanavat Pranams, and I'm really enthusiastic about this new direction, so thanks for doing it.
Yeah, somehow, I wasn't moving in the other direction the way I wanted. I also needed something easier for me, because I'm teaching it, because it's just so busy here with people. It was ecstatic when Raghunath came with 25 people, and Cuba, really had a mystical experience baking them in the forest at Vrindavan. But anyway, let's go on. Go ahead.
There's two things I was hoping to ask, and one is a kind of really just a historical sort of question. The other is more philosophical. Do you have a preference right now? I know you're tired, so do you have a preference?
Start with the historical.
Okay. When someone as powerful as Lord Chaitanya affects a place, sometimes it's hard to conceive of what it was like before his influence. And so I was wondering, you had mentioned that in Gaudiya Vaishnava theology, Lord Jagannath is a certain manifestation of Krishna with a certain kind of ecstasy. And I was wondering, do we know what the conception was of Lord Jagannath before the influence of Lord Chaitanya? I mean, do we have any idea
I don't know, but I know that there's many theories of tribal deities and, so many different conceptions. I don't really know the historical sense, but, the Rath Yatra was going on before Lord Jagannath, before Lord Chaitanya. He didn't start. Okay, Muni, so historically, Krishna conception of the Jagannath deity predates Lord Chaitanya.
Right. Okay.
How that happened, or was it always that way, I don't know. But Lord Chaitanya came there because of the Krishna conception of the deity, and that's the Rath Yatra. The Rath Yatra, it wasn't Lord Chaitanya that,
inaugurated it.
Revealed that the Rath Yatra is the mood of Krishna and Vrindavan. So that was predated Lord Chaitanya. I don't know, the history of it before but it seems to be a Krishna deity. Black, white, and Balaram Krishna and his sister.
Right. Okay. Do you have time for the other more philosophical sort of thing, or should I hold on to it?
I did. Let's go.
I appreciated the way you were explaining the mood prayer and the way in which it helps one cultivate a sense of dependence and gratitude. And it struck me that it struck me as something very similar to what I've been reading lately in Confucius, of all things. I had mentioned before that I'm teaching Chinese philosophy right now. And he often talks about the mental attitude of reverence, and that reverence is something like the acknowledgement that you're in the presence of something much greater than you. And so I guess what I'm wondering is... I don't know. Do you think it seems that a lot of these attitudes are things that you have to cultivate, you have to practice them. And you'd already mentioned that prayer is a very powerful way to cultivate this attitude of humility before God, before that which is greater. And I don't know. I was wondering if you had any other ideas on how that attitude is best cultivated. In relation to our attempts to develop devotion.
Your definition of ritual means to conform yourself to something greater than yourself. So I think it has to begin with ritual, it has to begin with somehow putting yourself in a position to feel humility, feel mercy. you know, centering your life on something greater than yourself. You know, even beginning with just Dharma, as Tom Wolfe said about the me generation, they never understood before self. You know, so somehow or other, acknowledging something greater than the egotistical has to begin that way. And then, in terms of the devotional practice of meditating and contacting God, which gives a realization of God, is cultivation of humility itself. One is the cultivation and understanding of your own position, and another is the cultivation and understanding of the position of God and realizing it through prayer, through mantra, through worship, through meditation, through focus. You get an experience of God. And then at the same time, you know, when you're hearing the sacred text, you know, when you're hearing the scripture, it's putting you in a frame of reference and an understanding. Buddha Bhava, you know, from the Buddha, from the understanding, will come also the feeling. Because, you'll apply your understanding and it'll enable you to come in contact with truth and feel truth. So, I mean, I think any of the spiritual practices, but I would say beginning with some ritual, some position of your body, of your words, of your, you know, and then of experiential feelings of it, then intellectual feelings of it. You know, guru, you know, you're serving someone. You're entering the world of someone who's in the world of God. Anyway, I think it's the whole gamut of the Krishna conscious philosophy.
It's interesting, though, because what you're saying reminds me of when you were giving lectures on the Bhakti Sandarbha, that Sharanagata, like to commit or to surrender, is really the first serious step in practicing bhakti. And it seems like what you're saying is that these kind of things, we can do them in various ways, but the right way to do them, to cultivate reverence and bhakti, is to commit to them and take shelter of them. And I find myself, I'm 35, I think, 35 now, and it took me a long while to understand the ritual.
Saying?
I think I'm 35.
Yeah.
So, I'd have to say I am. I'm 35. And it took me a long time to get here where, like, I find that, you know, as an American, I'm anti-ritual just by nature, typically. And then to join bhakti movements, although our tradition has a lot of ritual, we do rightly, I think, say that it's kind of secondary to the bhava. But it took me a long time to understand the role of ritual in self-cultivation, that it's not something external, and you have to surrender to it. And I appreciate the way you're framing things now. It helps me understand, you know, this Sharanagata or this surrender. You have to, it's like you don't just do ritual, you surrender to it, so to speak. Again, I'm just trying to think about it.
So, you're committing yourself to something greater than yourself. And really, bhakti is just dependent on, you know, it's really the entrance is surrender. And, you know, it's a simple thing, but it's so all-encompassing, right? I will do what Krishna wants. It's simple, right? But it affects so many details of your life, you know? So many attachments that you may have to give up, so many things that you don't like that you have to accept. And again, that's not misunderstood as renunciation, because surrender doesn't require that you give up everything. It requires you give up some things. It requires that you accept others. You know, Arjuna surrenders to fight, and he's a warrior. Wow, how nice. You know, your surrender is to do what's according to your nature. But, yes, surrender, it's just a pivotal key, you know. And it's just a one thing consciousness. And it's really what Diksha is. It's really what initiation is. It's that surrender. And it generally doesn't begin all at once. It's something that's cultivated and developed. But when it does begin all at once, then the full effect of bhakti takes place in one's heart. But until one actually surrenders, then his practice of bhakti is just surrendering. It's not really the deep feelings of devotion. It's just the practice of surrender. But when the surrender is there, right, when one actually surrenders, then that mood or consciousness enables one to fully experience the God and his manifestations in the various practices of devotional service. And when actually surrenders and he takes prasadam, he becomes freed from sinful activity. When actually surrenders and hears the Bhagavatam, then Krishna becomes rested in one's heart. Well, when surrenders, then you know the holy name. So it's that pivotal point. And most of our practice is just struggling with that. And that's why the simple soul, you know, the simple, humble soul, it's such a powerful thing, you know. And that's why, you know, learning is not bhakti necessarily. It's not that we don't cultivate knowledge. We cultivate knowledge to surrender. But if people cultivate knowledge just to increase their prestige, you know, then they don't get bhakti. So it's very fine line. Borijan said, you know, he said something ironic because he studied Prabhupada's book so thoroughly. He said, you know, I studied Prabhupada's books for 40 years and I came to the conclusion that the essence of spiritual life is surrender to Krishna, you know, through the spiritual master.
No, again, I know you're tired. I'm kind of inspired right now by our discussion, so I'm enthusiastic.
Yeah, no, I don't
mind. Go on. Okay.
Well, go on.
You know, this ties into what Borijan Prabhu just said, actually, that... and again, this is something that I've become very influenced by from the philosopher Aristotle and also Confucius, who are similar in their attitude towards ethical development, that to do something right, it requires basically three things. First of all, that you're doing the right thing. If you're doing the wrong thing, that's not good enough, right? So you have to do the right thing, but you also have to do it for the right reason. That is to say, you know, like you could accidentally do a nice thing, but you don't mean to, right? So you have to do the right thing for the right reasons, but beyond that, you have to do it with the right emotional state. That is to say, you have to love doing it. You know, to be charitable because you know it's right, but to not really enjoy it is not to be the best that you can be. And it seems to me that, like reflecting on what you were just saying about Borijan, you know, we can know on one level that I should surrender to Krishna, but it's very different to do that with the deep reasons that I know why it's right, and even beyond that, to do it with great emotion that I love doing it. And so in some ways, it seems to me, just thinking about it from this perspective, things like ritual, things like chanting, things like spending time with devotees or studying, you know, first you just have to do them, you know, and not do other things. But then after that, once you're actually just doing them, then you can work on the internal stuff, doing it for the right reasons and doing it with the right emotions. I don't know. And again, Marge, let me know. I'm just kind of enjoying thinking about it like this. I'm just putting that out, I guess. Did I lose you, Marsh? Swamiji, are you there?
Yeah, Mooney, I love that point, you know. You know, first you have to what? You have to understand that something is right. Not just do something, but understand something is right. And then actually have some emotional connection with it.
And, Marsh, do you still hear me right now?
I can.
Marsh, are you there? Okay. And it seems to me, Marsh, that that's where philosophy ties into bhakti. You know, obviously the goal is not just to merely understand reality, but it seems to me that the real proper place of philosophy within bhakti is, first of all, to defend what's right. Like, in other words, there's different options for the right way to live, so you have to give an intellectual defense of it. And then it also leads you to do the internal reflection on why it's right. So those first two things, it seems to me, are the role of philosophy. But after that, having the right emotional state, well, that's part of the internal kind of bhava. And that's where we would say that there's a limit to the role of philosophy, that simply knowing is not enough.
Wonderful, yeah. Wonderful, really.
Well, there's a lot of other things that came up, but again, I know it's late. Hopefully at some point Krishna will allow me to spend more time physically around you and maybe chat for a while. But
just say one more thing, because I do feel this is interesting.
Well, there's one other thing that came up, and it ties back to when you brought up the fact that we can't, and I really liked how you put it. You were explaining why it is that there's no qualification for bhakti. It's because if it's something's priceless, by definition, there's no price you could pay for it, right? And,
yeah.
But one thing I was wondering about is, and I think it ties into the things we've been talking about, but I'm not exactly sure quite how yet, is, you know, so much of my life as a devotee when I was younger consisted of really, I think, my desire to overcome the world in some way. And so I was really kind of conscious of how strict I was and how strict other people were. And I think I was often too judgmental like that. And yet that seems like even though that being judgmental is not good, doesn't it seem, Marge, that we're often really concerned about the details of practice and, oh my gosh, that guy's, now he only drinks milk and doesn't even eat grains. Wow, that's great. And yet these are all things that you can't quantify. Like, in other words, these are things that if bhakti can't be purchased, these cannot allow you to purchase it. And so I guess I'm trying to understand how these things play together. Like Rupa Goswami says that niyamagraha is destroys bhakti, and that could be interpreted as being overly attached to the rules. And yet, so is not being attached enough. And so I guess I'm just wondering, you know, if bhakti can't be purchased, what's happening with all of our concern with the details of kind of, I don't know, strictness or something like that? What is that doing?
There's two things. It is two things. One, when you love Krishna, you want to please him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's outlined in the Shastras, and certain things that you do. You know, and basically you're following those who know how to please Krishna. So naturally you want to do things the way those people do. So, I mean, that's a certain type of detail, but at the same sense, what actually pleases Krishna, the attitude. So there's a sense of that attitude in the details. Just following the details and following those things is not sufficient in itself, because there's so many reasons one can do something, you know, and it's not the ultimate objective. Anyway, I think it's getting late, Mooney.
Yeah.
I'm finding that the brain is limited, especially it's a little bit late here. But I love these conversations, so I'm really glad that you come on Sunday. I think it's interesting. Okay,
my pleasure.
Thanks, Bert. Okay. Thank you. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna? Okay, it seems it's shut off. Okay, Bunchakalpa.
Hare Krishna.